This podcast is sponsored by PAX. Whether on water, on land, or in the air, PAX bags are both versatile and flexible backpacks that are perfectly suitable for your requirements in the most demanding of environments. PAX bags are highly regarded due to their exceptional performance in pre-hospital and in critical care environments. Renowned for their durability, they endure harsh conditions while providing rapid and reliable access to essential kit. So their well-organized compartments and customizable configurations enhance efficiency in high-stress situations. PAX bags are designed with infection control in mind and are easy to clean and disinfect. The highly visible colors and reflective strips add quick identification and adherence to quality standards, assuring reliability. The versatility of PAX bags caters to a diverse EMS providers, but also delivers vital equipment and durability and ease of use for pre-hospital critical care services globally. I've used PAX bags in a number of critical care situations and they're absolutely excellent. Please see the show notes for further details. So on the podcast, we're just about to start with a question time over the next few weeks and months. And this is really about getting your questions in to the podcasting team. So between 4 to 5 of us, we'll gather every month or other month to really answer your questions as a listener group. So please do head to the show notes where you'll find a Principal Care podcast email. Do feel free to email us in your questions. And what we'll do is answer them between us as hosts. We'll do some research and background and contact all the different various guests we've had on the podcast and indeed other guests to get to you the best answers we can to some of your questions. So please do head to the show notes to the Pre-Hospital Care podcast email you'll find there and email us in your questions. This podcast is now live on YouTube, so please feel free to head over to the link in the show notes to watch this podcast or indeed this interview on YouTube and watch the interaction with the guests and feel free to rate and review and indeed subscribe to the YouTube channel. So please just head over to the show notes and you can find the interview on YouTube. Many thanks.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care podcast on the Medics Academy Network.
Welcome back to the Pre-Hospital Care Podcast with me, Owen Walker. In this episode, I'm going to be speaking about prevention of dementia with Ernest Fung. So what I wanted to do really in the podcast is really just examine dementia and Alzheimer's disease as it's a priority for many. So according to WHO, there are more than 55 million people suffering from dementia worldwide, and nearly 10 million new cases each year. So it's also currently the 7th leading cause of death, one of the major causes of disability and dependency amongst older people globally. So today I'm speaking with the Vice President of Clinical and Medical Affairs for CogniView, Ernest Fung. Ernest is committed to Alzheimer's prevention through cognitive health promotion and early detection. So CogniView provides cognitive assessment tools to healthcare providers for early detection of cognitive impairments, allowing patients to address modifiable risk factors earlier. So with a background in molecular diagnostics and life sciences, Ernest Fung is a board certified clinical neuropsychologist and a diplomat of the American Board of Clinical Neuropsychology. So with a career spanning over a decade, Dr. Fung has collaborated with physicians over multiple disciplines to address and treat individuals with central nervous system disorders. Ernest, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
I just wonder if we could start, Ernest, by just really getting you to speak to why dementia is such an important topic to combat from your perspective.
Sure. I think the first thing that comes to my mind is it affects everyone. It doesn't really matter where you come from, where you've been. Potentially, we all or our loved ones could be affected by this. And it is also not just a disorder for the identified patient. It affects the person's family. It would affect the whole family system for a long time, for years. People would have to learn and adjust over time. They often have to make really major changes to the way they live, which might not be the same, right, for other chronic medical disorders. And then, of course, we've got to think about the families too, right? Thinking about sort of caregiving burden over time. And there are also multiple factors that we know that could affect the way that the disease progresses, the outcome. And these factors could be in play even years before we know that someone might be suffering from a type of dementia. And so, with all this said, action and knowledge are both needed to sort of improve outcomes, to help people live more meaningfully, to help people to play a more active role in managing the disease, for sure.
So, Ernest, you're stateside, so in the US, could you maybe speak to some of the numbers in the US, just to give listeners a current, or indeed globally, just to give listeners a feel for the sort of, like you said, it does touch on multiple areas and multiple people's lives, and certainly features in pre-hospital care. Could you give listeners an idea of the enormity of the pathology?
Sure. So I will begin by saying that Alzheimer's disease is just only one type of dementia. It is the most common, but it's only one type. So when we look at data and numbers at times, they refer to either just Alzheimer's disease or just people suffering from a dementing illness in general. So according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and that's the CDC, like you said earlier, Alzheimer's disease was the seventh leading cause of death after COVID. But as of a couple of days ago, when I checked their website, it is now back to being the sixth leading cause of death. And COVID actually fell to number 10. And that's for the United States already. And globally, it is estimated by the World Health Organization that around 55 million individuals are living with Alzheimer's disease or other types of dementias worldwide. And according to the Alzheimer's Association in the US, around 6.9 million Americans who is above the age of 65 are currently living with Alzheimer's disease. So you're really looking at one out of nine people above the age of 65 who are living with Alzheimer's disease. And as you know, not just the population in the US, but globally, people are getting healthier as they are getting older, which means that they're more likely than to be diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease or other types of dementia as they get older.
So Ernest, you spoke to earlier, you know, the just the ability to catch this disease earlier can really start to mitigate some of the downstream effects and start to modify a person's quality of life. Could you maybe speak to what you have designed, or indeed what Cognivue have designed and implemented, both in identifying and mitigating the effects of dementia and Alzheimer's?
Sure. So we briefly talked about how the progress of the disease could be in place even before symptoms begin. And so, as we know more about the disease, in this case, I'm referring more specifically to Alzheimer's disease, we know that there are benefits to identifying possible changes in how someone remembers things, how someone's thinking skills are, to think about ways to improve the prognosis and outcome. So one of the missions that we have here at Cognivue is to try to find ways to enable physicians, from different disciplines to be able to reliably detect changes in cognition during its early stages. So we have lots of more traditional neurocognitive assessment tools that are very effective in teasing out people either who are cognitively healthy or people who are having maybe mild to moderate or severe cognitive impairment. And if you were to go for a full neuropsychological evaluation, of course, you're going to have that level of sensitivity, even on the milder end of the spectrum, for the neuropsychologist to see whether someone is having memory impairment or cognitive impairment or not. However, a neuropsychological evaluation takes quite a few hours to complete. And at least in the US, and as far as I understand, in other parts of the world, the wait list for seeing a neuropsychologist can be really long. And so I remember there was a time when people would have to wait for about a year to come in and see me. And that wasn't because I wasn't anybody special. It's just we didn't have enough people in our communities to make these, to do these diagnostic assessments. So what we need now is to have a way for example, primary care physicians, other types of doctors who can reliably tease out whether someone is showing cognitive impairment, and then make that decision whether that person should undergo further assessment, knowing that because of the health systems in multiple countries, an individual it might take half a year, 1 year, a year and a half, just to find out if they have a disorder like Alzheimer's disease. But if someone can perform screening effectively on the front end, we can immediately address certain risk factors. We can maybe put someone's mind at ease if they are observing some changes, but really they're actually doing fine. I think that's really what we need to do. So that's what we're trying to do, is to equip providers on the front end with more effective tools to help their patients and their families to figure out what was the next step.
So looking from retrospective data sets, Ernest, could you maybe speak to sort of how sensitive the tools are at detecting early onset dementia?
Sure. So thanks to technology, we are able to create and implement the type of testing paradigm that can detect smaller changes in cognition much better than the more traditional assessment tools. I'm not saying that the traditional assessment tools are not good, but when you think about the setting here, which is it could be a primary care physician's office, it might be at a pharmacy somewhere, you want something that is really quick. And because we're looking at the earlier stages of cognitive impairment or lack thereof, you need technology to do a lot within a very short period of time. So for CogniVue, the whole thing takes about 10 minutes, and you get the report, and it shows the physician or the pharmacist where that person falls, whether the person is within the normal range or whether their performance fell in a range that would raise some concerns about how they're doing. So I think this is where not just CogniVue, but the industry is focusing on, is coming up with reliable, valid cognitive testing tools that can be implemented easily in someone's office and can get their job done in a short period of time to enable a physician to make those decisions. Because as you know, oftentimes they don't have a lot of time with a patient. It's not because they don't want to, it's just sometimes they have a lot of people to see a day.
So you know, the software that you are operating collects 130,000 data points on patients. That's a lot of data, actually. And so I guess my question would be, so how does this sort of cognitive tool then focus on bespoke patient care prospectively after it's collected these data points?
Sure. So I'm happy to report that we don't show the 130,000 data points to other people, because that's just going to be too much. So what we want, right? We want something that is quick for the physicians or the pharmacist or even an audiologist, right? In the moment to find out what is going on. And so on the back end, the program analyzes all these data points, and then it produces a report that is available immediately that has an overall performance score for the test taker, as well as breakdown of their performance in different domains, like processing speed, like memories. So because you don't want a test that is quick and effective, but then takes the person even longer to understand the findings, right? You want those two things to be consistent. So it, all those data points are basically analyzed and combined and into basically main numbers so that a physician can just look at it and go, okay, I think I know what to do. And I think I've got enough here to explain to my patients what might be going on and why, for example, I'm making a referral for them to see maybe a neuropsychologist because, look, the memory score is quite low. I'm concerned about this. So let's do more tests to figure out what's going on. So in a way, the data, the scores enable the physician to make tailored recommendations, treatment plans to each individual patient, depending on how they did on the assessment.
One of the reasons I think, Ernest, just to speak quite candidly, why I was so interested actually in this is because in pre-hospital care, paramedics have really, or pre-hospital clinicians really have, you know, little time in the whole trajectory of care to really articulate and also to attribute some of these findings to the patient. And so I think there's real value in having, you know, 10 minutes is it would be perfectly acceptable in a subacute patient to be able to sit with them, run through a test like this. So I can really see the applicability into pre-hospital care. But could you maybe speak to, because there is utility in hospital and in the pre-hospital phase of care, could you maybe speak to some of the other tools which are maybe available to clinicians that help clinicians sort of evaluate and or treat patients?
Sure. So I think it depends on the setup of different practices, right? And I think some physicians, they might not be that comfortable talking about cognition if that's not part of their primary training. So it's perfectly understandable for a physician who feels that way to make an immediate referral to another discipline if they were to come across someone who complains about having memory issues. So for example, if a patient is 75 and they go in to see their primary care physician, but that patient already has a list of medical problems that particular physician, like a family doctor, we need to address, given like the 9 or 10 minutes that might have together, that physician might then choose to address what the person came in with and the verbal complaint of, oh, by the way, doctor, I've been kind of forgetful lately. I don't know what's going on. The doctor might just be like, you know what? We'd love to discuss further, but I might just have to kind of refer you out. But then there are other doctors who might want to do more assessment on the front end to sort of figure out, okay, are there interventions that we can implement at this time, or should we make a referral as well? And so for that type of approach, there are already some tools that people have been using, right? The mini mental state examination, the MoCA, which is the Montreal Cognitive Examination or assessment. And so there are tools out there. But one of the challenges using these tools is that, number one, they involve a person administering the test, which means that there's potential error in administration. You know, nobody's perfect, right? And then also, it takes the person's time. If it takes about 10 minutes, then the physician or maybe the physician assistant or a nurse will have to spend that time with the patient for that amount of time. And they are not really that repeatable. There are alternate forms, but you can't really use the same thing to track someone's performance over time. But the digital tests, that's what they enable you to do. And so when you think about an illness, that is characterized by like a gradual decline of functioning over time. You really want to have a tool that could help you track that in the same tool, right? So that you can compare performance over time. And so, yes, I think there are clinical tools that are already in place that people have been using for a while. But I think now, because the technology has evolved to the point where it can be implemented easily, quickly, and dare I say affordably in different practices, I'm seeing physicians from different disciplines who are basically willing to change things up to say, hey, you know, we recognize some of the limitations of the tools that we have. I would like to find out more about what a digital cognitive assessment could offer me to see whether this could actually improve the quality of my work, the quality of my care for my patients. And so I'm seeing that change right now. It's really encouraging, actually.
So one of the seminal reports, actually, Ernest, that came out in 2020 was the Lancet Commission report on dementia prevention, intervention, and care. It was a seminal report for a number of reasons. It features ubiquitously across a lot of dementia prevention websites. Could you maybe speak to some of the takeaways for indeed yourself and indeed Cognivue from that report?
Cool. So one thing that I think it's in a way, it's encouragement in thinking about dementia is especially applicable for what we're looking at, in the sense that when we think about a neurological disease, we think about the brain, right? And so I've had conversations with patients about risk factors and how to, you know, encourage brain health to minimize risk factors to their cognition. And we talk about the factors that are identified, right, in the Lancet Commission paper, you know, talking about managing hypertension, talking about managing weight, you know, maybe quitting smoking, addressing mental health. And oftentimes the response that I would get is, yeah, those things make sense. It's good to do, but we're talking about brain here. What's, you know, smoking got to do with my brain health? And, you know, yeah, my blood pressure is high, but we're not talking about blood here, right? And I'm like, no, like the brain is part of our body. So whatever that is good for our body inside and out is going to be good for our brain. And the brain is such a complex organ. It utilizes a lot of blood. What, you know, what the blood could bring to the brain, right? And so anything that is related to blood could potentially affect the integrity of the blood vessels, hence cognitive functioning. So when you think about the commission's paper, you're looking at, you know, educational level, hearing impairment, blood pressure, physical activities, diabetes, social contacts, air pollution. All of these factors are not just limited to one area. And this speaks to the importance of, you know, if you want to make changes, we have to go beyond individually tailored interventions, because a lot of these would involve and would benefit from public health programs. And that's really what the Lancet Commission has sort of talked about as well, is in order to make meaningful changes and moving the needle, right, for these risk factors, you've got to do it at the individual level, but you've got to do it also at a more sort of community-based level. And then one positive thing also is that if someone were to present with more risk factors, that doesn't mean the person would be less likely to benefit from changing of those factors. In fact, the author suggested that essentially the potential for benefits is likely higher for people who have been, you know, quote unquote, more deprived. And so I think that's really positive, because it means that we can all do something to contribute to brain health. It's never too late.
So do you think, in a way, because that is really, like you say, it goes beyond bespoke care. It goes from the individual to the social to the community based, and so it's more holistic, really. How do you see that shaping dementia care from your perspectives, either from innovation? Well, yeah, from innovation, really, from how clinicians innovate to providing this holistic care.
Sure. So I think one thing that we have to think about is, I mean, it sounds corny, but we have to think outside the box, right? So we've been talking about settings where you have someone who's a patient of a clinic and they go in to see a physician and the person reports they have problems. But when you think about our communities and healthcare in general, those are not always the story of people, right? And so oftentimes what ends up happening is someone is not even part of a healthcare system, meaning that they might not even have a doctor until they actually end up in the emergency room. That's not good, but it's happening everywhere. It's happening everywhere in the US. It's happening everywhere in other countries too. So you're looking at people who really would have benefited from education, implementation of treatment way before they get to the point where they have to go to an emergency room. And so what I have seen, and I'm very happy about seeing, is efforts to, at a more grassroots level, to get more individuals and their families to come out to get education about brain health. And so what Cognovate has been involved in, and I love the fact that we're doing this, is we have been involved in community brain health events where we might have a physician who gives a brief talk on brain health, on the things that, you know, people could do to improve the health of their brain functioning. And then we have community cognitive memory testing events where people would actually line up and take one of our brief assessments, right? It takes about 10 minutes. And one thing that people love about that particular, the particular tool is they don't feel like they're being tested. So the traditional tools, it's sort of like you're being tested by this physician or by this psychologist, and it just doesn't make people feel great. But when you do like a digital cognitive assessment that feels like a game, people find it so much more pleasurable in a way. And they're more open to being tested again, right? They're not going to be like, oh, I remember this last time. I did not like it. I'm not going to do it again. And when in a community event, when they see other people do it, it eliminates that barrier to being quote unquote tested. And so we have had people lining up to take it. They can share the results with family members in the doctor's office. You might be able to bring one family member in, but you know, like sometimes, especially with some immigrant families, they want more extended families to be involved, right? We can't just look at one type of, you know, culture. And so that's what I've seen is the use of this type of new technologies in community health settings that are bringing more people out. And then those are the opportunities for people to sign up to have a doctor. So if the report says, something is kind of concerning, it warrants further investigation, then there are volunteers who would help them sign up, maybe check their insurance. If they don't have insurance, maybe they can point them to some community clinic to get them connected with a provider, right? So that we're able to address their concerns and not wait until they have to go all the way to the emergency room, because by then, oftentimes, it's too late.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think, like you said, that early recognition and mitigation is absolutely key. As we're coming into land, Ernest, just a couple more questions, really. One is really how you see these developments aligning with sort of just some take-home points, really. Things that you are advocating for as part of Cognovue, and just kind of things that people could kind of anticipate down the line from a dementia recognition and care perspective.
Sure. Maybe I'll answer both of those questions at the same time because I see them to be related. So looking ahead, and I think a lot of people are aware that there's currently a medication, right? Leqembi, or lecanemab, that has been approved by the FDA, and it's able to slow down the progression of the disease. But not everybody can actually be on this medication. So you have to be within a certain impairment level in order to benefit from the medication. So this speaks to one of the important points about early testing and detection of impairment is that if someone is, would be appropriate to undergo this treatment, you don't want to miss that. You don't want that person to eventually come into a doctor's office or the emergency room, but by then their symptoms are too severe to benefit and be qualified for this particular medication. So we want people who are able to benefit from this medication to have the potential to benefit from it. And then at a different level, talking about kind of some of the ticking points and sort of looking ahead, I do think that knowledge is power because I think knowledge gives us sort of the upper hand to manage this disease. And I think this is applicable to multiple sort of parties or different levels. So technology now, right, can provide doctors with the knowledge of how a patient performs from a cognitive standpoint much earlier. So this gives them the knowledge that they would need to know to provide education, relevant implementation of strategies and treatment, and also make appropriate referrals early in the treatment process. Then the knowledge, right, would also help the patient to better understand what's going on, to help them then start to make better decisions about their own healthcare. Maybe eventually living situations, the level of assistance that might need to really increase the level of engagement in managing their own health. And one thing we know about research is that people's ability, and that's including you and me, our ability to listen to our doctors and do what they tell us to do is affected by how engaged we are in our healthcare, right? So if I am concerned about my own health, I'm more likely to do what my doctor tells me to do. If I don't care, I'm not going to do it. And then finally, knowledge could also help family members, because like I said at the beginning, it is not just a disorder or a disease for one person. It affects the family system. So having that knowledge as early as possible helps families to plan ahead, to work with the patient, to make the best decisions about what should happen, to understand more about what they might need over time from a caregiving standpoint, maybe from a financial standpoint, to build in a support system, right? To anticipate if things were to go worse over time, then that caregiving burden needs to be addressed. So I do think that knowledge is power. In this case, it empowers multiple people within this system to do the best they can for everybody involved.
And it's been absolutely fascinating just unpacking the subject with you and indeed getting your perspective. So thank you for the last half an hour.
Oh, you're welcome. It's my pleasure.
You're listening to the Pre-Hospital Care podcast on the Medics Academy Network.